It is member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, and all things considered, I'm Dave Lawrence. So grateful that you have joined us today. We have a real special thing we're doing here in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Hot Tuna, and we're doing it with a lot of style, I think. We've got Jack Cassidy and Jorma Kaukonen here with us. They are really legendary cats. They were in this room, I think it was this exact month in 2015 that we did a little, didn't play live, but we had a little chit-chat in the room. They are tonight at the Hawaii Theater. This tour is celebrating a half century of music together, and it's a thrill that you brought your instruments. Welcome, and thanks for being here, Jack and Jorma.
Thanks for having us.
That's a real treat that we've done this. And we go back a little ways.
We do.
I wanted to just show you this, just to break the, to warm you up to the room a little bit. This goes back to 1998, and we actually did one of these in Boston.
Good heavenly days. I didn't have as much forehead back then. Yeah, look at this.
And holy, so it's holy. Like and a real... Back in November 1998, the whole band in the studio. Let Jack see that crazy thing. He won't even. And you got the whole band in one shot.
We do.
And then us in the other shot. And it's kind of cool just to think about all these years. That was 21 years ago.
That's right, 21 years ago, man.
And we, in 50 years, there's been a lot that you guys have done. And in this year, it's almost like I was looking at your history of dates so far in 2019. You've done a little bit of everything. Yeah, you're acoustic tonight. It's Acoustic Tuna tonight. But right. In 50 years, there's been electric shows. There's been acoustic shows. And in this year alone, there's been both of those. You've done a little solo stuff. You've had some collaborations. I like to think one of the big highlights of the year, though, was the 75th birthday party and celebration for you, young man.
That was terrific.
When you look back at that, because as we reminisce of 50 years, let's start with that. What are highlights of that evening?
Well, it's interesting to group together events in your life in 25-year segments, which now I can do. So it was great. Everybody's so sweet to me on my 75th. And Jorma and I had a little chat. We were talking about how it's great to have an art form and a craft work that to us is today is more essential than it's ever been. And it's I'm just grateful to be able to keep it all going and of course segue into tonight's show, which is the most important thing for us right now.
It's a great and it's to do this kind of 50th anniversary tour and to be doing this acoustic version again. It's the same year you have done some electric sets too. Does the set? I know Jorma's the set crafter. Does the set reflect anything different this year when you're crafting it?
Well, we're really lucky because we get to morph some of the acoustic tunes into the electric set. Justin, the guy that plays drums with us. Is his Americana sensibilities are really good as a percussionist, so that works out also. But I mean, there's some songs that are just headbanging rock and roll songs, and those would not show up in an acoustic set. But so many of the fingerstyle things translate very well into the electric set also, and a lot of that has to do, just to geek out briefly, because we could spend a whole show on this alone, with the kind of gear I have. I'm playing through this. One of the guitars that I use in the electric show is a thing called a Gibson SST, Chet Atkins guitar that they don't make anymore, that enables me to do, it does not sound like an acoustic guitar as they hoped it would back in the day, but it's almost impossible to feed back. In an electric band context, I can do all the stuff that I do on this guitar in it, and it works.
Versatility.
So, it just depends on what we're doing. This is sort of the softer, more introspective side of Jack and Jorma.
And when you get to, but have you dragged out songs maybe that you hadn't thought of just because when you think of the 50th, or does it not influence the set?
Not specifically, because, and a lot of that has to do with me just being lazy with stuff like that. Well, we dredge some stuff out occasionally, but the thing is that at this point, I'll mess around and take chances when I'm sitting around at home and fooling around and rehearsing. But when we're playing in front of people that have bought tickets, I mean, it's not to say that we phone in the parts or that they're scripted. Right. I really like to know how the song goes without having to think about the next chord.
You have this connection to our islands that goes back 50 years too. I've got this listener, Steve, the mystery emailer, and he sends tidbits of, like, he's got all the dates, everybody. I don't know what he ever did. He's kind of, he's a mystery. So he'll email me things like this, Jack. March 8th, 1969, the Jefferson Airplane, making their Hawaii debut, performed before a sold-out crowd at the Blaisdell Arena. One of the supporting acts, Lee Michaels, with his drummer, Frosty.
That's right, Frosty. Absolutely.
You remember it?
Oh, absolutely. Lee Michaels and Frosty. I mean, Frosty was a great drummer. And Lee Michaels had a great personality, stage personality, I remember. And, you know, it was a dynamic show they did.
What year was that again?
That was March 8th, 69.
If I remember correctly, Paul, may he rest in peace, I think he got popped for smoking pot on that trip also.
Wow. Here in the... In Hawaii.
Yeah, I believe it's funny enough,
because I thought you were going to remember this. 3 days after that show, so it was March 11, 69, Jefferson Airplane performed a free concert at the Waikiki Shell, drew 10,000 fans. When asked why they were doing it, Grace Slick said, quote, "If we have the equipment and it's nice outside, we do it."
Exactly. That's our girl.
Yeah.
Do you remember that show? Probably not.
Vaguely.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I mean, actually, we spent a bunch of time on the island on that trip.
Yeah,
I was just talking to one of my friends. In those days, you could rent a dune buggy. Remember dune buggies with the Volkswagen? You could actually rent those things. They're probably illegal on the road today. Who knows? Anyway, we had a good time.
That's and we'll talk about your friend in 1 second, actually, because Yorma's got a powerful airplane Hawaii connection, which he's going to reveal in a second. But here's the first tuna date in the island. So same year. Again, celebrating 50th anniversary of these guys here, Hot Tuna, in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. It was October 17th and 18th, 1969, 7 months after their March visit. Steve writes, "The Jefferson Airplane returned to Hawaii, two-night stand, Honolulu Civic Auditorium, opening act, Hot Tuna, making their Hawaii debut." At the time,
oh, that's interesting.
Tuna was Yorma Jack, Marty Balin, and Spencer Dryden. Newspaper review said, "Yorma used a three-finger bluegrass style of playing that adds a lot of color."
Oh, this is fantastic.
To the lead guitar. And at that time, the airplane had a terrific light show, he said, supplied by Glenn McKay's headlights.
That's right.
I stand corrected. That was the time Paul...
got busted?
Languished in Durant's file, yeah.
So Steve's memory helped to...
Absolutely.
Every little bit helps in the memory department.
Right, exactly. Steve, they're sending you high fives. So what... Yorma was just alluding to, and I don't know, I guess you probably know this because you mightn't have an idea what he was up to yesterday.
Yes.
So Yorma, as we, again, talking about highlights of a 50-year career, which is a lot of time. That's older than I am. I haven't even been on this planet.
Hang in there, buddy.
I'm trying. So you have a bud here in the islands.
Right.
Who has real strong connection to the airplane.
Yeah, this is a friend that I've known almost as long as Jack. So anyway, when I went to the University of Santa Clara in California... In 1962, it was a very conservative Jesuit school. And the first days that I was there, I saw this bearded guy, which is a big deal back then. Not a big deal today, but it was back then. And we became friends. And his name is Bob Kinsey. And he has lived in the island for 40-plus years. He's a marine biologist. It took me to Coconut Island yesterday. But anyway, so he said, "There's this guy you have to meet." And his name is Paul Cantor. And so he took me to Santa Cruz, where I met Paul, and the guy became our road manager. A guy's name is Bill Laudner, and they were surfer dudes back then.
What an incredible... I mean, it's just
you
like,
can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, critical connection.
So I told him that had I not been at that school and had not we become friends, my life would have been considerably different.
Right. I mean, and the pop culture... The impacts of this guy, and he's right here in the Aloha
That's
State,
right.
Jack.
Yeah,
we
right.
got some credit with the whole airplane and the history of
that
stuff.
That is incredible.
I dig it. No, you guys, and he was talking about how, you know, he's known him almost as long as he's known you. One of the great things about these two cats is the synergy that you guys have. And I've seen it many times. It's remarkable. And you've described it, actually. The last time you were in the room, Jack, you were talking about that in the interview. I was hoping, since we have instruments in your hands, excuse me, we could get a little demonstration
Absolutely.
Of just what it feels, you know, what it is that you guys share. When you have a friendship that long, it's over 50 years you've been friends, huh?
1958. 62 years.
Incredible. 62-year friendship translated to music right here in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. Whatever would make you feel good, I just want to hear the synergy.
Okay.
I try to get away from him, but he keeps pulling me back.
Yes.
Godfather. Anyway, so... Baby, how long that even train been gone since that blood red sun went down? Well, now I'm walking down the track, Mama Lord, I said, feeling so sad. Lost the best woman man ever had. How long? Well, how long? Baby, how long? Well, how long? Baby, how long? That evening train been gone. Been gone since that blood red sun went down. Since that blood red sun went down. You know, I thought I heard a whistle, Mama Lord, and I think I see a train. Deep in my heart there is aching pain. How long? Well, how long? Baby, how long?
Atherton Performing Arts Studio, and Jack Cassidy, your McAlkinen, doing what they do best. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's what that is. They are tonight, Hawaii Theater, and celebrating a 50th anniversary, which is one of, it's kind of like, it's startling when you think about that. Like,
yikes. How?
I know, right? And the same year that Jack had his 75th birthday and a great celebration. There's a lot of synergy between you cats, and it goes way, way back. 62 years, is that what you said?
Yeah.
You know, how'd you first meet?
Well, that's a good question. My dad had been stationed in Pakistan from the early 50s until 56. And when we came back from that posting, I had a friend, the guy that actually started me playing the guitar, this guy, Mike Oliver. To make a long story short, he lived in the neighborhood and went to the same elementary school and junior high school that Jack did. And through him, I met Jack's older brother, Chick, and we became friends. Chick was a little bit older, so he had a car. So he was a desirable friend to have in those days. And but Jack was interested in music, and we discovered that we had more common grounds than just an automobile. And That's when we first met.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I was in all these three schools, the grade school, the junior high, and the high school, were all within a three-block radius of each other. Yorma School, where he went, was a little bit across town. But when he went to high school, it was all the neighborhood. And there was a lot of hanging out to do around high school time, junior high. But we had mutual friends that played. A character named Bob Linder played banjo, and some other people appreciated bluegrass, and all the kinds of music came through the D.C. area. But the first times I remember, Yorma came over with Chick and my older brother, and we had record listening sessions, and we'd be up in Chick's room listening to records and come down to my room, listen to some records, and of course I had instruments, I had a guitar, and that I think that's what pulled us together, just the love of music and the fact that he played guitar and I played guitar, and that's how we started playing. And as I've said before, in another circumstance, a junior high school guy, you know, wouldn't be hanging out with a high school guy too much. But in this case, it didn't really make much difference.
That's a great point.
You know, I was 14 and a half, going on 15, and he was 17, going on 18. And we just started a little band together and playing the kind of stuff we listened to. And, you know,
The Triumphs?
Yes. You know, a little Buddy Holly stuff, some, you know, a bunch of things that we could play in our primitive playing.
But you notice Jack was playing guitar in that story. He wasn't a bass player back then. He was the lead guitar player. And I played rhythm guitar and sang.
Yeah. And we played Johnny Cash stuff and little Gene Vincent, you know, stuff like that. And that's what it was about. You know, we found something to do. And of course, don't forget, this wasn't like today. Our parents were leaning over us, trying to push us into the music industry. If anything, it was quite the opposite.
Right.
And it was okay to play music, but, you know, go to school, go to college, and get some sort of real profession going on.
Right.
I think that later on, that drove us to do pretty well, to do really well at what we did, you know.
We're still waiting for the bubble to burst.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned a great thing there, Yorma, because you're like, that was when, you know, Jack starts on the guitar before he heads the bass. Do you still remember finding that first guitar in the attic back in 1956?
Absolutely. And I wish I had that. It was my dad's. And, you know, when you think about these things, when you're kids, you just find stuff. You know, it's an attic, and you go up there, and you...
Sometimes it's stuff they want you to find it. Sometimes
yeah,
it is.
Exactly. You're always hunting for something to get on your parents. You know. You know. You don't know about. But in any case, there. I remember up in the attic, there was a Washburn guitar, which was a classical nylon string instrument, a four-string banjo, and a pair of speed skates. And in the 30s, speed skating was really popular back in then. And I learned how to play guitar and speed skate later on, as it worked out, you know. And I didn't really start thinking about that until later on. But it's amazing what can happen.
A trip to the attic.
In the back of your mind, maybe you want to emulate some what your parents do or something. My father was a dentist, so he'd long given up the guitar playing and the speed skating. But he kept music in the house at all times. He was an audiophile, and he collected music, and that's where I got a lot of my early classical and jazz. Experiences at a very young age, 3, 4, 5 years old, you know.
Your dad also had the Fredericks of Hollywood catalog, too. We like finding that also.
Yes. Diverse man.
He also built himself the rec room, the classic 50s rec room, you
man
know, with all the accoutrements that went along. We won't go into that right now. Things that would probably be politically incorrect today.
Dear old dad.
And do you have with that guitar in the attic discovery story from your partner, there has to be a parallel.
Well, not, you know, it's, I mean, that's, you never know. I mean, there are no coincidences, so that's really pretty cool. This guy was telling me about Michael Falzarano. I'm not Michael Falzarano, Michael Alvary. When I came back from Pakistan, he was playing the kind of music I started out playing. And for some reason, the guitar knocked me out. Now, my dad had a secretary when he worked for the government, the Department of Labor, who was from Puerto Rico, and she played guitar. But I remember the first time you pick up a guitar, because I played piano, and you go, it's like, what do you do with that? I mean, you actually, there's other stuff you need to learn how to do. So Michael taught me how to do stuff, and I wanted a guitar, and my dad said, you got to learn to play two songs. and then I'll get your guitar. And so I laboriously learned to play two songs. Now, those are songs I did with a flat pick, and I've got finger picks on today, but sort of more or less. Takes a worried man, sing a worried song. Takes a worried man, sing a worried song. So worried man, sing a worried song. I'm worried now, but I won't be worried long. So anyway, so I'd play stuff like that. My dad would go, "What do you know about being worried?" And because I, as a teenager, I wanted to tell him a lot, Dad, but because I wanted to get that guitar, I told him nothing. And I wound up getting a guitar and taking some lessons, and the rest really is history.
No, it is. It's huge history. I guess part of that, though, is the reason I wanted the explanation on the Jack getting the guitar is also when it's twofold. It's both a great story of how you start on the guitar, but talk about the switch to what you've been known for. I mean, those are stories that people don't really know you for.
Well, there's a bit of a prequel to it. I forgot really quickly. When I found that Washburn guitar in the attic, it disappeared. I was just 11 or 12 years old, and it disappeared around Christmas time. And I didn't think much of it because, you know, you got other things to do. I wasn't playing that or anything. And I was just plucking around. It only had four strings on it. And then Christmas came, and I went downstairs with two brothers, a younger brother and an older brother, and we trotted downstairs Christmas morning, and everybody had presents stacked up and all that kind of stuff, you know, and this is Washington, D.C., and there wasn't too much for Jack there. You know, I looked around, and I guess it was a little po-faced, but up on the tree was an envelope, and on that envelope said Jack, and I opened up the envelope and said, "Dear Jack, this entitles you to 12 guitar lessons at the," I forgot the name of that local music store. And we had the guitar upstairs that you've been playing fixed and strung with steel strings, but it didn't get repaired in time for Christmas. It'll be ready in a week or something like that. And what's interesting about that is my parents had seen me, heard me playing around like this, and they did the great thing. They didn't waste any time. They got me a set of guitar lessons, sent me right out to start where I actually had to do something right away with a certain amount of discipline. And like Jorma said, learn a song, learn the notes, you had to learn some picking technique with my Gibson guitar instructional book. That is a whole other story. And so a few years later, I was playing. Started playing with Jorma. We had our band. When Jorma, of course, 3.5 years older, he went off to college the next year, and I started moving around in a variety of different bands in Washington, D.C., playing with some of the people that had played with us, or Ronnie McDonald on drums, and Warren Smith, a few other people. But to make a long story short, there was a circuit that we played in all the clubs later on, and I had ID that said I was 18 when I was 15, and I started working these clubs regularly on the weekends and all summer long at playing guitar. And one of the other guitar players in the D.C. area, and there were many, many musicians on all walks of styles of music, but one of the other ones was Danny Gatton. Danny Gatton turned out to be, well, then when I met him, he was a year younger, but he was the wonder kid he had won banjo contest and violin contest and guitar contest when he was 12 years old. He just had an ear that was amazing. And so anyway, we became pals, and we traded off in different bands and substituted in different bands, you know, within that circuit. And when he called me up and asked me one summer, he'd booked the summer, and he said, the bass player, and there are very few electric bass players. This is 1960. Very few of them. Most bands had stand-up bass players. And he said his bass player got a terrible illness, was going to be in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And did I know of another bass player? And I said, no, I didn't. And so he hunted around. He called me back up, and he said, listen, Jack, why don't you do the gig? And I said, I'd love to, but I've never played bass before. And of course, the classic line came out, how hard can it be? It's only got four strings. But that got me off to to starting to play the bass. And I borrowed the other gentleman's bass, which was a Fender Precision bass. Now, this was the new Fender Precision that had come out a couple of years earlier, not the old one that looked like a Telecaster. Hmm. And a sculpted back and all that. And I played the gig, but I found the bass, and I loved it. I fell in love with the bass. I really, you know, and as I've said it before, I could make an okay guitar player, but the bass really captured me. That year, Fender came out with the jazz bass, the Fender jazz bass, which had a little more narrow nut at the top and two pickups, more tonal variations. And that was the first year that came out in 1960. I bought that bass, and my work quota went up exponentially. And I started working in a lot of bands, playing, you know, in one band guitar and another band bass. And that's how I started out. So when Yorma called me up in 1965 and he had just joined this folk rock band, of which I didn't believe, because I figured Yorma the purist, he's never going to be with another set of drums again, you know. And he asked me, you know, yeah, when he said he'd just joined this Jefferson Airplane band about a month before it was in July it was formed, right? And we were talking in August or something. I came out in October, but he said, what are you doing? I said, the usual thing. I'm going to school and keeping out of the army, and you had to keep a C average, you know, and playing guitar and bass. He says, and I think Yorma knew I played bass, but he never heard me play bass. And so I came out to California to try out for the Jefferson Airplane without him having any idea whether I could play bass or not.
Wow. Now that's amazing.
I had faith.
A lot of faith. A lot of faith.
Yeah, he picked me up at the airport. I remember he looked at me after we got in there. Of course, I'm showing me out looking like a college nerd with a tweed jacket and mustache and everything. And he looks over at me and says, "You better be able to play the bass."
And you realized at that time you were basically going to make him drop out of school to do this gig.
Well, you know, we hadn't really, our lives hadn't really intersected for a couple of years. And I just graduated for college. I don't think I gave the dropping out of school a second thought.
And all these years later, I guess you haven't either.
No.
I knew he'd be there for me.
Yeah, exactly. It turned out to be okay.
Yeah.
It turned out to be great. You know, luck and timing and preparation. I was ready to play, but I was so bored with the scene in D.C. because none of the bands were really allowed on any of the club work to do original stuff. It was all you had to present, you know, other
covers
stuff, you know, that was out. And you could only go so far with that.
It's a great story. And it's there are a lot of collaborations that go on for a long time, but I think we'd be hard-pressed to find other ones that similarly have a 62-year friendship and a long professional career touching on so many different kinds of things over the years, being very adapted, and you've just done a lot of good stuff. Would you be willing to play another song since we
love? Boy, that's really asking a lot. Yeah, why not? Sure.
It's Hot Tuna, and they are in our HBR Atherton Performing Arts Studio as part of All Things Considered.
See, I just started playing a couple chords, and this radio, not video, but he looked at me, nodded knowingly, presuming that I was actually going to play this song. No, I actually am going to play this song. It's called Tune of the Year.
It'd be nice.
Thank you. seasonal change, and she's yearning to shake the trees of our lives in the streets where the leaves are for burning. Things on this earth were made for the dying. Look in our soul, says it ain't much use trying. Too many years just to watch our hearts die in this way.
Love the little visual.
We're not
cues.
Always that downbeat, but I like that song.
It's a great one. And with the years theme, it goes with the 50 years, and with the there's a appropriateness to
indeed
to the lyrics there. And I love the cues watching you look over. There's a lot of little subtle cues that you don't get on the radio with yeah. you watch these two, and that's what I meant about the synergy of.
Well, you know, one of the things I think from my point of view, because people often ask us, I mean, the obvious question about, you know, how we can basically have coexisted so long in this way. And I think the reason for me is that even as kids, and we met as kids, we respected each other as men or people, however you look at it, and artists, you know. Because if we had more time, you could find out how different we are. Because
I know
we
that.
Are. But we've always, like, just let each other be each other, and that's the deal, you know?
I know that. That was one of my questions. I mean, we could... these are cats. That's why when I showed you those pictures, I mean, we could talk for... We'd be in here for days if we didn't have other stuff to do. But that was one of my questions, is you guys are so different from each other, but yet... there's a lot of lessons.
Well, Barry Mitterhoff, you know, he's a mandolin player we toured with for a number of years. He used to call us the odd couple.
Right.
You can figure out which one's which.
No, I totally. I mean, and you don't have that. Do you have any ink?
You know, I beg your pardon?
No ink on you. No tattoos.
Yes, I do.
Oh, you do have a couple?
Yes, I do. Okay. But, you know, I think also, you know, part of the craft of any good relationship for a period of time, not only allowing the other person to be that other person, is also learning from the other person. I think we learn from each other, you know, because we do see things differently, but it's almost the same desire to approach life, getting the most you can out of it, you know. So we're both prepared to learn rather than put up a block to just defend your own way of viewing things. So, you know, there's some things you come along and, you know, it's interesting. Jorm is a lyricist and a writer. I'm not. But as I grow older and I look at his lyrics over the years, it fascinates me how my understanding shifts and changes of what he's talking about in
the meaning.
His writing. Like any good writer, you go and revisit a good writer's works at a different stage of your life, and other things come up.
Yeah, it takes on new meanings.
Meanings come up through you. And I think we do that for each other, so that now, as far as, from my point of view, the time we share now together is more precious than ever. And when we go on stage tonight, and I tell people this, particularly those that think that are always looking for the easy way to explain something, they say, oh, you've played so much together, you must know what the other guy's going to do. And it's absolutely the opposite of that. Every time we go on stage, it isn't like we wonder if we can do what we once did before that was good or something. It's the desire to put yourself in that moment that night. And that's the craft work there that comes in. That's part of the discipline, is to get on that stage and be ready to do that night's work.
That's the vitality of it. And that's a great way of describing it. It's an incredible thing. We're very fortunate. They are tonight at the Hawaii Theater. They are celebrating 50 years together as a band. They have deep connections in the islands, as we were hearing during this conversation as well, both through their own history and through friends and stuff. And some of those people here in the islands helped bring Jefferson Airplane together, is basically. So it kind of gives you chills when you think about it. Hot Tuna, and in our HPR Atherton Performing Arts Studio, Jack Cassidy, Jorma Kalkinen. And I certainly hope that you have had as much fun today as I have. I give you huge, huge mahalo for doing this.
Well, listen, thanks for having us. And in the words of my dear friend, Roy, the great Roy Bookbinder, I just got to play the guitar and talk about myself. I can't do that at home.
Right on, my brother. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you.
Okay,
man.
You bet.